It is Tuesday, December 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the suspect in Monday's New York bombing is charged with terror offenses. Russian President Vladimir Putin says he will withdraw Russian forces from Syria, but not everyone believes him.
In the strict sense of the term, he may be correct, but there's still a lot of action to be seen, I think, by Russian military in Syria.
And the nominations for Hollywood's Golden Globe Awards are announced. We'll get reaction. It's all ahead. New York police said Tuesday the man who set off a crude pipe bomb in the New York City subway system Monday has been charged with making a terrorist threat and supporting an act of terrorism. The suspect, 27-year-old Akayat Ula, was also charged with criminal possession of a weapon. Authorities say Ula, a Bangladeshi immigrant and former taxi driver, used Velcro and zip ties to strap the explosive device to his body Monday, but that it did not fully detonate. Karen Greenberg directs the Center on National Security at the Fordham University School of Law in New York City. She spoke with me about the use of the Internet to gain information on bomb building.
What it does show is that, as we've known for years, since the earliest al-Qaeda attacks after 9/11, that there has been online information about how to build a bomb, or in the words of the al-Qaeda magazine, how to build a bomb in the basement of your mom. But it turns out that it's not so easy to build a bomb, and this is what we've seen time and again, particularly these sort of homemade improvised devices. And so, yes, there is information about it. How reliable that information is yet to be seen. It doesn't seem to be that reliable, but it doesn't mean that it isn't dangerous and that someone couldn't get hurt. So it's not as if somebody could create, we think, a massive bomb that would kill hundreds of people. But there can be damage. But it's very hard to build a bomb, and we've seen that time and time and time again, that building an explosive device is difficult.
Well, now, this particular suspect, according to police and investigators, and again, this investigation is continuing, but he was not on the radar, even though he was an immigrant from Bangladesh. I believe he had worked as a taxi driver. You know, he was not on the radar of law enforcement authorities.
And there's no reason. Maybe he should have been. This isn't exactly a al-Qaeda-like cell that's creating some kind of plot and imagining some kind of attack. This seems to be an individual who decided that he wanted to conduct this attack again, something not so easy to carry off. I think the message to take from this, and even from the Saipov event last month, where the individual drove a truck into those who are on bicycles and walking down in the face of Manhattan. I think that the lesson to be taken away, and I think what the NYPD has done very well, is to realize that, of course, they cannot predict any lone individual who's going to decide to do something harmful to his fellow citizens and residents. And so what they've done is they've decided to be quick response teams, to have enough cops in enough places with enough training that they can impede, stop, and respond to an attack as quickly and professionally as possible. And now we've seen this twice in a row. There have been many other incidents where I'm sure they've had to respond and that we haven't heard about, where they think they've deterred other potential attacks. But the fact is that this idea of 100% prevention is not the way to stay safe. It's good to have preventive measures. It's good to have preventive law enforcement. It's good to have preventive intelligence. But when it comes right down to it, it's just as important, if not more important in some instances, to have well-trained, on-the-ground, responsive teams who understand how to deter violence. And that's what you saw this time, and that's what you saw last month in New York.
Well, and this is all occurring during the holiday season around the world, and particularly New York City, where there are a lot of visitors, a lot of tourists wanting to look at the lights, wanting to go to the stores and partake in all that. And this suspect picked an area, you know, near the Port Authority, where there's certainly a lot of people, and near Times Square.
Yeah, actually, that's a very important point, because what you've seen in at the end of 2016, when we had the Chelsea bomber that tried to set off four bombs, one successfully in New York and in New Jersey. And when we saw this with Saipov, the individual with the truck that mowed down people last month, they were out of the way. They were not near where you normally see dense crowds like you would at the World Trade Center, like you would at the Empire State Building, like you would at Times Square. This was more central than any of those. And so that is an interesting fact to note. But even there, he wasn't able to do what he wanted to do. And because at the denser places, you have even more policing than you have in places that are more remote.
That's Karen Greenberg, the director of the Center on National Security at the Fordham University School of Law. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, a lot of big political news today on social media. A big Senate race in the state of Alabama, usually a reliably Republican state, but a very contentious election to fill the seat vacated by Jeff Sessions when he became attorney general. I know you're going to be talking about it later on in the show, but we're seeing things like hashtag Alabama Senate, hashtag Alabama Senate election trending, and also Dear Alabama, as people make their last-minute pleas to voters for the two candidates, either to reject Roy Moore, who's been accused of sexual assault and child molestation, or to reject Doug Jones, who's seen as someone who supports things like illegal immigration, gay rights, and abortion. Not a lot of pro arguments, a lot of anti. It's been a very negative campaign, and that's played out on social media. Another negative campaign or back and forth that we've seen on social media involves New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand. She's been an outspoken advocate in the Senate for sexual assault victims. And yesterday she tweeted that President Trump should resign and Congress should investigate the sexual harassment and assault allegations against him. Now, Trump countered that with a tweet where he said that Gillibrand would come to his office begging for campaign contributions and would do anything for them. Now, many people, including Gillibrand, are taking issue with that phrase, would do anything for them, calling it sexually suggestive and demeaning. Gillibrand herself called the tweet a sexist smear, and she responded on Twitter saying that Trump cannot silence her or the millions of women who have gotten off the sidelines. But, Sarah, this is just the latest war of words on social media between the president and a prominent politician in the U.S., and I'm willing to bet, and I think it's a fairly safe bet, it will not be the last.
I think you're right about that,
yes.
Andrew. All right, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories. Survey in the eight show of a majority of people believe the government corruption has risen under the administration of President Donald Trump. The European Union ends its support for Cambodia's electoral authority. A British banker appeals his conviction of a double murder in Hong Kong. And the Paris Climate Change Summit is focused on boosting funding for fight against climate change. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Imagine you've discovered a rare gem of a car that's been tucked away in a barn for the last 37 years. The barn's owner says it's yours if you can drive it away. But if you've ever tried to start a motor vehicle and keep it running after sitting idle for so many years, you'll find it isn't as easy as it sounds. Now imagine having to do this with a vehicle at nearly 21 billion kilometers away. Voyager 1 mission engineers and technicians at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory did just that recently by successfully firing four of its thrusters for the first time since 1980. An official with the Voyager mission says the successful firing of the thrusters will make it possible to extend the life of NASA's farthest and fastest spacecraft. Voyager 1 is the only human-made object that's in interstellar space. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Alabama voters will decide a key Senate race, and we'll have a report on that. Russian President Vladimir Putin traveled to Syria, Egypt, and Turkey this week in what is viewed as a victory tour. He was critical of President Donald Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital, calling the move move destabilizing. He was preparing the ground for a missile defense deal with NATO member Turkey and proclaiming victory in Syria. Ahead of next year's Russian election, Mr. Putin stopped at a Russian airbase, announcing the withdrawal of a significant part of Russian forces sent to Syria 2 years ago to reverse the fortunes of government forces battling rebels since 2011. The U.S. Defense Department, however, is skeptical of the announcement. The Pentagon said past Russian statements about removal of their force do not often correspond with actual troop reductions. Indeed, Mr. Putin indicated Russian forces are in Syria to stay. Trinity University history professor and Syria watcher David Lesh, in speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty, said he is equally suspicious.
Putin has announced withdrawal, and there have been mostly a rotation of troops. So I guess in the strict sense of the term, he may be correct, but there's still a lot of action to be seen, I think, by Russian military in Syria. The province of Idlib is largely under opposition control, and there's no way the Syrian army could take that without significant help from not only Iranian and Hezbollah militias, but primarily Russian air power. So Russia is going to need to stay around for a while. But I think Putin, you know, very much is very eager to give the impression, particularly to various sinecures of power back in Moscow, that Russia is, in fact, withdrawing, particularly before the presidential election in 2018, where I think he really wants a one-sided popular mandate in order to enact the type of policies domestically, internationally that he wants to do. There's no question he's going to win. But I think he wants to clearly show to the Russian people and to these various sinecures in power in Russia that this is not, you know, the Soviet Union in Afghanistan in the 1980s. It's not the U.S. in Iraq after 2003. In other words, that they're not going to get bogged down in a quagmire. However, that's easier said than done. As we know, you know, President George W. Bush proclaimed mission accomplished shortly after the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. And of course, as we know, it was anything but. And I think the Russians, you know, while they are very eager to declare victory so that they can keep their two bases in Syria and then get out as out of town as soon as possible, they still have a lot of work to be done in there.
What constitutes victory for Russia?
I think right now is just the appearance of military victory, which I think they've gone a long way toward, but also getting a political settlement, which will kind of be the icing on the cake of their adventure in Syria. And I think part of Putin's visit was once again, because he just saw Assad in Sochi a little while ago, was to put pressure on Assad to really make the concessions necessary for political reform that will bring about a viable, sustainable political settlement. And Assad and his government are feeling very good about themselves these days, and I know for a fact that they very much do not want to engage in the type of political reform that will enable a sustainable political settlement. So I think there's some give and take between the Russians and the Syrian government right now, and I think this is in part an attempt by Putin to put a little bit more pressure on Assad to make the political concessions necessary to get a Geneva process going that could lead toward a political settlement.
David Lesh of Trinity University also said Mr. Putin was in the region to prepare the groundwork for the signing of a defense deal with Turkey for S-400 surface-to-air missile systems. Turkey, a member of NATO, has been in discussions with Moscow for a year. Lesh said it's part of Turkey's evolving Syria policy. He said while no longer seeking Bashar al-Assad's ouster, Ankara is now focused on the Kurds and its border with Syria. All eyes are on Alabama, where voters Tuesday will choose between Democrat Doug Jones and Republican Roy Moore to become the state's next U.S. senator. Moore, the state's former chief justice, is accused of sexual assault and pursuing teenage girls when he was in his 30s. Reporter Deborah Bloom went to Alabama for VOA to find out from voters how the controversy is playing out.
A special election in the southern U.S. state of Alabama has the whole country talking. Republican Roy Moore and Democrat Doug Jones are vying for a seat in the U.S. Senate, in a race that has far-reaching consequences for the nation. Whoever wins will not only go to Washington, but they could change the balance of power in the Senate. A win for Moore would mean Republicans would have a tighter grip. But if Jones triumphs, Democrats could feel emboldened and pose a greater challenge for the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump.
We don't need a liberal person in there, a Democrat.
In a deeply conservative state like Alabama, Roy Moore would seem the obvious choice. But allegations of sexual misconduct are overshadowing his candidacy. Multiple women have accused Moore of coming onto them as teenagers. One woman claims Moore groped her 40 years ago while he was driving her home from work. She says she was 16 at the time.
I was terrified. He was also trying to pull my shirt off. I thought that he was going to rape me.
Moore denies the charges and says they're meant to discredit his campaign.
These allegations are completely false. They're malicious. Specifically, I do not know any of these women, nor have I ever engaged in sexual misconduct with any woman.
Despite this, many voters are undeterred, casting doubt on the allegations against him.
These allegations are totally false. I know the man. I know what he stands for.
We kind of live by the system, innocent until proven guilty. So I feel like we've started a bad pattern with a lot of people getting accused and accused of things that happened 20, 30 years ago.
But others feel differently, determined to see Jones take office.
I think it would be disgraceful for the state of Alabama to have a national representative like Roy Moore. It'll be bad for the country, bad for the state.
Lawmakers say if Moore wins, he'll face an ethics investigation in the U.S. Senate. But whether or not he gets to that point is for Alabamans to decide, while the rest of the country anxiously watches. Deborah Bloom for VOA News, Montgomery, Alabama.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. The Hollywood Foreign Press Association announced its nominees for this year's Golden Globe Awards, with a Cold War fantasy romance, The Shape of Water, leading the nominees with 7. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the nominees ran the gamut of performances and subject matter in what is regarded as a key predictor for the Oscars.
You may think that thing looks human. Stands on 2 legs, right? But we're created in the Lord's image. You don't think that's what the Lord looks like, do you?
This creature is intelligent, capable of language, of understanding emotions.
Guillermo del Toro's magical drama about a relationship between a river creature and a mute cleaning lady, The Shape of Water, gathered the most nominations with 7. Sally Hawkins was nominated for her performance along with Octavia Spencer and Richard Jenkins. Del Toro received a nomination for his directing.
This is a devastating security breach that was leaked out of the Pentagon.
The most highly classified documents of the war.
The Times says 7,000 pages detailing how the White House has been lying about the Vietnam War for 30 years.
The way they lied, those days have to be over.
Steven Spielberg's film about press freedom, The Post, got 6 nominations, including for Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks, and one for Spielberg. Others up for Best Film include the British World War II drama Dunkirk, the gay romance Call Me By Your Name, and the drama 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
She signed a petition to stop our production of Avenue Q.
This is the play where the puppets drop the F-bombs.
Cool. It is not only not about that, but it's actually a play that you should see because it deals with the struggle of young adults being disillusioned with life. Mm. Feeling demoralized and defrauded by the false promises of tomorrow.
I can get all that here.
In the television category, HBO's Big Little Lies was nominated for Best Limited Series, as well as acting nominations for Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, Shailene Woodley, Alexander Skarsgård, and Laura Dern.
The world has changed. Society in Britain has changed.
You married a wild spirit. Trying to tame them is no use.
Two Netflix dramas were nominated for the Television Drama Awards, The Crown and Stranger Things, Hulu's The Handmaid's Tale, HBO's Game of Thrones, and NBC's This Is Us are also nominees. In the wake of the sexual assault scandal swirling in Hollywood, it was thought that female directors might be nominated for their work, including Wonder Woman director Patty Jenkins and Mudbound director Dee Reeves. However, no women were nominated for Best Director. In the Best Foreign Language Film category, Angelina Jolie's epic about the Khmer Rouge takeover of Cambodia, First They Killed My Father, was nominated, alongside The Square from Sweden, Germany, and France, the winner at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Other nominees in that category included Chile's A Fantastic Woman, Loveless from Russia, and from Germany and France, In the Fade. The Golden Globes will be handed out January 7th in Hollywood. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Thanks very much, David, and that is our show for today. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Through its binational commission with Nigeria, the U.S. hopes to find new areas of collaboration with regard to security cooperation, economic growth and development, and democracy and governance. In the northwest region of Nigeria, Boko Haram and ISIS West Africa have wrought a great deal of destruction on the Nigerian people, forcing more than 2 million to flee from their homes. Speaking in Nigeria, Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan said, "I want to emphasize that the United States is Nigeria's partner in this fight. We are committed to helping the Nigerian people provide their own security." The U.S. has helped Nigeria modernize its military, but a military response alone in the Northeast cannot lead to sustained peace, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. Nigeria's success requires improvements to the economy and governance off the battlefield, including credible investigations of human rights violations and mechanisms to hold those guilty accountable for their actions. To help those affected by Boko Haram rebuild their lives, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced that the U.S. Agency for International Development will contribute an additional $45.5 million. The United States will continue to support food security and nutrition programs in Nigeria, including development programs focused on the northeastern states. Predictable economic policies and a transparent justice system are necessary to create an environment for growth and to attract businesses and investment to Nigeria. Sufficient energy resources are critical to fueling growth in Nigeria. Through the U.S. government's Power Africa initiative, the U.S. will help the Nigerian government serve the majority of Nigerians who currently lack access to electricity. In particular, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced a $1.3 million project to address the shortage of gas available for gas-fired power plants under the initiative. Finally, in addition to supporting the security and economic growth of Nigeria, the United States recognizes that good governance is necessary to sustain both over the long term. Fighting corruption and ensuring free and fair elections will make the government of Nigeria more accountable to its people and better equipped to secure its citizens and keep its economy growing. The United States looks forward to working with Nigeria to reach their shared security, development, and governance goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.